I would like to propose a new mechanism for controlling atom-atom interactions, basically by DC electric field. If realized, we believe it would have significant implications for both Bose and Fermi systems. This is the work we've been working on at Georgia Tech, which is in Atlanta, which is not on the coast. And this is work being done with a postdoc, two beginning PhD students, and two actually special programs students also contributed to the numerical work. Of course, our work is funded by ONR and NSF. Let's start by looking at how do we handle atom-atom interactions, usually for quantum degenerate gas. Well, if the gas is dilute, we second quantize them and only keep the binary interactions, which where this VR is the atom-atom interaction potential. Maybe in momentum space, it look more clear is that you have two particles coming with different momentum, and they scatter, and the two other particles coming out. I want to emphasize here, this in momentum space, if you just Fourier transform this, you will realize this scattering amplitude is just the Fourier transform of the bare atom-atom interaction potential. Okay, so this is nothing, basically, but the first-order Born approximation to the scattering between two particles. We know if we want to do problems perturbatively, we don't usually use the real Fourier transforms of the bare potential for various reasons. First, we can always renormalize this. Secondly, there are potentials. Most potentials have hard cores where this Fourier transform is not well behaved. So that doesn't really bother us. We always introduce some kind of effective interaction, which from microscopic field theory, you can use this so-called ladder reformation. So basically, you allow these two particles to interact to all orders in this binary scattering. And then in the many-body theory context, you obtain this four-point vertex function. And I learned a great deal of this from actually this paper by Belyaev. And then if it's in the dilute limit, usually you make the approximation, you say, oh, what's really coming is a two-body really scattering amplitude, okay? Then if the energy is very low, we know there's no dependence here. If the potential is really short-range, then you end up with basically just a scattering lens here. This is sometimes called shape-independent approximation. And I really want to understand this from the point of view as illustrated here. Basically, I would say you just replace whatever the bare potential by a contact potential such that when you make a Fourier transform on this, you obtain the exact scattering amplitude as calculated from the real interatomic potential. Okay? We have already heard talks yesterday about how to change the scattering lens, thus change the interaction of the condensate. Well, in fact, for this trapped Bose condensate, it's very interesting because the interaction strength is dimensionless and it scales with the scattering length divided by the ground state of size. So in essence, if you want to change the scattering length or interaction strength, you can achieve that by simply changing the ground state size as well. In fact, this is what they do. In the beginning of the evaporation stages, they do ramp up the trap, so it interacts a lot stronger. Of course, what I'm going to talk about involves changing the scattering lens. Let's look a little more carefully about what is a scattering lens. I guess most of you are experts on this. But, well, let me just remind you, for a typical cesium-cesium model potential, for instance, this is the potential between two cesium atoms. At short ranges, you have repulsive cores. This is mainly due to the poly exclusion principle between fermions because atoms are composed of nucleons and electrons. And then you have this potential well, which typically is a few atomic units. And then in the long range, you have this van der Waals type of interactions, which typically takes this form. You have C6, C8, and C10. Okay? And if you, the leading order term, of course, is 1 over R6. If you are beyond a few thousand atomic units, then the retardation of effects comes in, and actually this C6 becomes a 7, okay? So if you look the low energy scatterings within such a potential, and we know this is a spherically symmetric potential, so we make a partial wave expansion, and for each of the partial waves, the Schrodinger equation goes like that. You have, you know, this is a radial Schrodinger equation, and you have centrifugal barrier here, and this is your kinetic energy, this is the real potential, intermolecular potential. If you look this, and in the case of the S wave scattering, when L is equal to 0, this term is not there, okay? And if you, kinetic energy is also 0, and if the potential asymptotically is 0, basically you have a second order homogeneous differential equations. So in the large R limit, your solution should become a straight line, yes? This is actually what we do find. If you solve for low energy solutions, you see in the inner ranges, there's a lot of oscillations, but in the end, the wave function just goes into a straight line. This line intersects, of course, with the internuclear radius, and this point is the scattering length. Now, I want to make a point here. You often hear people say that scattering length sensitively depends on the potential. In fact, it's very easy to understand this because for the S waves, you don't have a centrifugal barrier, okay? If the potential is deep enough such that, for instance, in this case, it contains actually 62 bound states here, okay? Then when you integrate these equations, all the phase shifts you are accumulating is huge. So any slight variations of potential actually would change the asymptotic behavior greatly. C6, this is all in atomic units. So C6 is in atomic units, is basically atomic energy units times the distance to length scale to the sixth order of. Because this is a zero energy state, actually close to zero energy, it's slightly positive. There are many oscillations simply because this well supports many bound states. So the, yeah. Oh, this is a many bound states. For typical molecular potentials, it can support up to, you know, several hundred bound states. So in this case, we used this for cesium. Actually, it has 62. And another point I want to make here is that you have to match smoothly what is these inner range potentials to the asymptotic range. In fact, inner range usually is best determined by the experimental data, like using RKR techniques, and Professor Strolley is a leading expert in this area. And if you change the point where you're matching by, you know, the last, the second digit after the, you know, decimal places, you can in fact affect asymptotically the behavior greatly. So you can get all kinds of scattering lenses. So it's quite remarkable that within the last several years, experimentalists have, you know, worked very hard to give us very accurate scattering lenses. Okay? Now that is for the case of model potential. But for the purposes of my talk, I would want to do this textbook problems to illustrate some of the points so that we may understand what is the best way to control them. Let's just consider the case, simple case, of a spherical potential well, okay, with a well depth of V0 and a radius of R0. And in that case, I can solve these Schrodinger equations analytically, and there's no big trouble. And if I define this phase shift divided by K, and if I take the K limit where K goes to 0, that corresponds to zero energy scattering, and I obtain this formula for the scattering length, okay? I can plot it out here, okay? And you can see scattering length goes from plus infinity to minus infinity, plus infinity to minus infinity, as with the increasing of the depth of the spherical well. And this is easily understandable because these dashed lines are nothing but the resonances which are going from above threshold to become a bound state. So if we have a bound state immediately below the threshold, the scattering length becomes infinity, okay? And to plot this curve, I mean, it is only possible, in fact, for the S wave to do this because in this case, the potential is a spherical well potential. So it's exponentially decays to zero. It's a really short range potential. So the phase shift, only the S wave phase shift is proportional to K. And for other partial waves, the phase shift goes as 2L plus 1. So the contribution to the scattering cross-section is only from this term. All these other terms in the limit K goes to zero, they go away. Okay? And this, of course, for real interatomic potentials, they are not exponentially decaying to zero, and they are not really short-ranged. There are these weak potentials which we have to worry about. For instance, here are the analytical properties of the phase shift in the low energy limit. If the potential goes to zero as 1 over IN, okay? Typically, only people usually actually do this for N larger than 4 for some reasons I will address. So if this is the asymptotic form of the attractive tail of the potential, then you can easily prove analytically, this comes from analytical properties of the S matrix, is that the scattering phase shift for partial wave L goes like K to the 2L plus 1 if your L is less than that. And it goes like N minus 2 if L is larger than this value. Let's look at what is this value. For the case of van der Waals potentials, this N is 6. So this is 6 minus 3 is 3. I get 3 half. So that means for typical atom-atom interactions in ground state, the phase shift for both S-wave and P-wave obey this formula. For P-waves, it's proportional to K to the third. Okay? But for other partial waves, that means for L larger than 1s, it all obeys this, which basically says it's proportional to K to the fourth. Okay? So it is not always like this as in the case of a truly short-range potential. What? Yeah, yeah, large distance, that's a good point, okay. Now, the R equal to N equal to 3 case is actually quite a peculiar case. This is, in fact, a problem solved in quantum mechanics book of Landau Lifshitz and chapter 129, if you're interested. Okay? In that case, we know this potential is long-ranged, and they consider the case where you have a constant here, and it's spherical symmetric 1 over R third potential, okay? And the scattering amplitude, this is elastic scattering amplitude, actually is logarithmically divergent. This Q is just the momentum transfer. And why it is logarithmically divergent? In fact, if you work a little harder, this is usually not work out anyway. And you can see that the phase shift to the S wave partial wave is divergent in the limit K goes to infinity. But the phase shift for all these other partial waves are in fact finite. They are proportional to K. And in fact, they can be described also by this formula. So if you put N equal to 3 here, you can see this is 0. So for L larger than 0, all the phase shifts are proportional to K. So that means if you have 1 over R third potential for all the partial waves except the S waves, your phase shifts are all proportional to K. In this sense, you can have the scattering ends for each of these partial waves. But of course, when you try to find the cross sections, you have to sum all of them, and you will find that they are also divergent. So this result is the sum of two divergent terms. Okay? So, as I mentioned, we propose actually to use DC electric field to do this. So, how a DC electric field would change this situation? When we started this about a little over half a year ago, there are basically two ideas. People, you know, I ask them, scattering experts. One says, well, when you have a DC electric field, your interaction potential actually goes like the following, which, you know, if you're interested, you can actually solve this. If you put two atoms in an electric field, you know, the ground state of the atom cannot be the ground, bare ground state of the atom anymore, because they become polarized. So your true ground state of the atom now, instead of just being the S-wave ground, S-spherically symmetric ground state, you have to mix in some kind of P-state here, yes? So atoms, instead of becoming very small spheres in the low energy limit, they become very small dipoles. Of course, the strength of the dipole depends on the strength of the electric field you can put on. And in the case of two atoms, you have to worry about what is the asymptotic behavior of the potential. Actually, you can do this. I mean, this is actually become possible after this postdoc to join us, because he was, many of you probably know, he's the leading expert in calculating the long-range coefficients. So we did this, in fact, in the first-order perturbation theory. You can show that the asymptotic potential, instead of just these long-range coefficients of the van der Waals type forms, you pick up an additional term here, which is 1/3. This coefficient is just the polarizability of two atoms times electric field strength squared, but you have a polynomial here, which is a spherical harmonics of the second rank. This potential is anisotropic. Okay? And there are other high order terms, you know, if you're interested in, or if I have time, I can show you how to do this. And basically, you know, you have to sum all these kind of diagrams, you know, then you obtain this. Okay. This potential is anisotropic. And it is, in fact, quite similar to the case of liquid helium-3 or nuclear forces. Okay. In the helium-3, of course, this is a spin-dependent. Here we have a spin-independent potential. And so how would this potential contribute to the low energy behaviors of the scattering of two atoms? Well, as I told you when we started this, basically two kinds of answers, which is not surprising. Some people told me, you know, basically this potential doesn't contribute, so there's nothing. The reason is this potential averages to zero. Yes? If you take an angular average of a solid angle of this thing, this potential doesn't contribute. So this is not surprising if you consider, if you stick to the S-wave collisions when with two dipoles, they come in, they collide equal probably in all the directions, it's the average is to zero. And of course, there will always be other opinions. And other people told me this potential is 1/3, so it's divergent. Yeah, I mean, this is as different as you would get. Yeah. Yeah, there should be an you're exactly right. But this is, in fact, the spin, the magnetic dipole moment interactions is also of this kind of form. But in that case, the magnitude is rather small. In fact, it contributes to the dipolar relaxation. Okay? So, how does this potential really look like? This is how it looks like, okay? So instead of spherical atoms with just a spin pointing in the direction, now each of these atoms becomes two little dipoles. You could say there's a negative electron in this direction and a positive electron in that direction, yes? And if they interact this way, that means on top of each other, so that their internuclear axis is parallel to the direction of the electric field, which is polarized the direction of the dipole of the atom, you can see they are attractive. The reason is obvious. This guy attracts this guy, which is stronger than repulsion, yes? But if they interact sideways, you know that it's going to be repulsive, because these two guys repulsive each other stronger than this guy attracting each other. Just to consider the dipole has a finite length, okay? And in fact, once we realize this, we look back, it is really not that surprising, because even back in 1995, when Bose-Einstein condensate was voted the molecular of the year, the artists already know that Bose-Einstein condensate is not spheres. They have all kinds of structures, you know. I tried to explain this to actually some high school kids. They, in fact, asked, you know, to say why this holding something. So, how would this anisotropic potential change the situation? Well, it turns out we have to do a collision, a multi-channel collision theory of this problem, which in fact we couldn't find that it's been done, you know, anywhere in the textbook. The basic idea is that when you learn collision theory, for instance from Gordon Benz's quantum mechanics book, which actually was the one we are using for graduate students, and you always make a partial wave expansion. But partial wave expansion is only possible in the traditional sense if the potential is spherically symmetric. Okay? And in this case, if we include that anisotropic terms, the potential actually becomes of this type of form. You have a spherically symmetric term, which in the low electric field case is pretty much the standard intermolecular potential curves. Okay? Now this dipole polarization induces another term, which is of this spherical harmonics 2-0 type. Yes? So to do this type of calculation, in fact, is quite trivial. At this time, I should also take the opportunity to thank Tony. A few months ago, when he visited me, I was trying to explain to him this idea. The first question he asked is the potential anisotropic. Then I thought, well, I remembered in his paper, review paper, there was something. So when we went there, in fact, in that case, the potential is all similar to this form, except you have a spin-spin interaction coefficient here. Okay? So how do you do the collisional theory for this kind of potential? Well, it turns out, in this case, you can expand your wave function into this basis as well. And you obtain, instead of just partial wave expansions for wave functions attached to this channel, you will have partial wave expansions for wave functions which have two indexes. Instead of just LM from this one, you will have L prime M prime from the left-hand side then when you try to reduce the equation down. So you will have a multi-channel equation which looks like this form. You know, it's very complicated and involves many terms. But the net result is if you try to do analytical analysis is that you can actually find generically your scattering amplitude for the two-body scattering amplitude depends on K and the K prime. That's not surprising. What is the K prime? K prime for elastic collision is the same in magnitude as K, but it's in the direction of R, of the intermolecular distance, because this is the amplitude of the scattered wave, so it has to depend on R only. And generically, you would have a scattering amplitude which is proportional to this form. You have to sum over all L and M's. Okay? So you have Y, L, M, K, and the Y, L, M, K prime. Of course, then, what we have to understand is what is the low energy properties of these things. In the case of spherically symmetric potentials, we know that in the low energy limit, only the S wave is proportional to K, so that K cancels this K, that's why I obtain something finite. So what happens in this case? Well, here's the answer I can tell you, is that it turns out in the low energy case, all these T matrix elements are proportional to K linearly. So that means this guy divided by that gives you infinitely many scattering lenses. Of course, these are called the reduced T matrix elements. Okay? So why is it so? I want to give you a quick answer here. The reason is, in fact, you know, quite obvious once you realize what is going on. It turns out when you have this type of potential, you try to do a multi-channel scattering calculations. This term, which is proportional, this term, which is proportional to 1 over R3, only contributes to diagonal terms of the collision scattering equations for partial waves involving L larger than 1. Okay? This term is 1 over R3, so they contribute to a diagonal term to partial waves of L larger than 0. Basically, first order P wave, D wave, and F wave. I mean, all these higher ones. And they also contribute to an off-diagonal term, which mixes all these channels on the right-hand side. This, you know, for instance, this is the channel index. Okay? This is the coupling. Okay? But this 1 over R 3 terms does not contribute any diagonal terms to the S wave channel equations for scattering. So if you want to do this naively, you can introduce a Green's function for all these other partial waves, then derive effective potential for the S channel, S wave channel. In that case, your interaction, effective interaction would be quadratic in this, because this is a coupling. So that means this N-isotropic potential introduces only diagonal terms of 1 over R6 to S waves. But it contains diagonal terms of 1 over R third to all these other partial waves. If you remember what I told you earlier about analytical properties of the phase shift, these two conditions allows us to say that all the partial waves are actually, their phase shift is proportional to K. In fact, all of them. So this actually makes the numerical work a lot easier, because you can do try to solve these multi-channel scattering equations, and you pick an energy. For instance, in our case, we basically pick about 100 microkelvin. We know when you are at 100 microkelvin, typically for spherically symmetric atom-atom interactions, you are already dominant biased wave. And in this case, in fact, 100 microkelvin, everything is already in the asymptotic limit. Okay? So the net effect is really because of this N-isotropic interaction, which induces the low energy T matrix to be all of the order that is proportional to K. So that means this reduced T matrix in the low energy limit all becomes fine. So what is the usual scattering length for S wave? And this is a number, okay? So after we realized this, you know, we said, well, maybe things can be rather easily calculated. It took a few months of programming, and I want to show you some results here first. In the previous transparency, when I showed you the cesium molecular potential curves, which is like this one here, I remarked that this matching point between the asymptotic range and the intermediate range, if you change that radius in this, for instance, this column here, this digit, which is less than, you know, 0.1% here, if you change that digit just by, you know, 1, and you can get this same potential to give you all kinds of scattering lenses. Okay? So this is what we have done. We just do this calculation with the electric field for various field-free scattering lenses. So this is the scattering lens, or for instance, this one we tried to mimic the lithium-6 triplet scattering lens, which is very large and there's a zero energy resonance. And this one we tried to mimic the cesium zero energy resonance that just has been discussed. What we find is very interesting. And with electric field, this is probably rather high, of the order of 100 kilovolts per centimeters. You can change the cross-section for atom-atom interactions dramatically. And for instance, these would be the values corresponding to the field-free scattering lenses. Okay? So when you tune on this, you see all kinds of resonances showing up. I would comment here, you know, this is a logarithmic scale. And these resonances, in terms of this field, are much broader than the Fischbach resonances of the magnetic field. That's why, you know, you cannot pinpoint down on one side very precisely. I mean, for instance, if you park your electric field here, I mean, we believe, you know, it would significantly increase the interaction between atoms. And every time you see a resonance, it's corresponding to the fact a new bound state is born in this distorted potential, which is N, spherical and anisotropic. And then, so this on this side, the scattering lens becomes changes the sign. Okay? So here are a few observations I want to make. to find it. First, as I showed you, that these cross-sections, because of the fact all reduced T matrices are now contributing, so your cross-section cannot be described just one scattering length due to the S waves. You have many, many scattering lengths due to all these partial waves. In fact, all these partial waves couplings, they are all finite. In the case of fermions, you have to do the symmetrized case. Suppose the atom is in the triplet spin state. That means the spin wave function is symmetric. And then all these terms contribute, and typically, I will show you how do they compare different order of magnitude of different terms. So we define an asymmetric parameter, which is basically how dominant this S wave scattering length is compared with the total cross section. Okay? And for the fermionic case, if they are also in the triplet spin state, then all these L's needs to be summed up. And I want to remark here, you know, if you have a spherically symmetrical potential, the cross-section for fermions here is very, very small in the energy k goes to zero because all these terms would become zero. But now, because of the k dependence, all these things are finite. So in principle, they should be of the same order as the cross-sections for fermions. So a few simple observations here from our calculated result. First, if the field-free scattering length is negative, as in this case, which is negative, and then which is this is negative, and this is also negative, then when you turn on the field, the cross-section always rises first. Okay? Why is it so? This actually can be easily understood from this spherical well potential model I showed you earlier. No, these numbers are the zero field values here. Basically, they are corresponding to here. But all these values are here are significantly different, okay? So first, for negative scattering length cases, when you turn on the DC electric field, they always rise, okay? And one of the reasons I made this transparency for the spherical well is here. Why do they rise? It's because if your initial scattering length is negative, that means you can either be here or here. Can you see me? And so when you raise the electric field, you're basically making the well deeper and deeper. So you're moving this way. Your scattering length becomes larger, and your cross-section increases, okay? For the case when the field-free scattering length is positive, this is the positive, and this is positive, they always go down first. And this is precisely what we can learn from this model, too. If initially you are here, positive, when you turn on electric field, you first have to go down. Okay? And this same reasoning also allows you to understand why there are so many resonances here. Because when an additional bound state is born in the potential well, then you would have to go through a resonance. You would shift it the sign from minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay. So for instance, I mean, even for non-quantum degenerate gases, maybe this dependence of the cross-section on the electric field would allow you to say something about the sign of the scattering lengths, if you just do a field-dependent measurement. Yeah. And this is really the logarithmic scale, you know. In the linear scale already, you notice the changes here already. So you don't need as high an electric field. So what else can we learn from this? we can also make the interaction completely anisotropic. I defined this anisotropic parameter, which is basically the contributions of the S wave, which is completely spherical symmetric compared with the total cross section. So what does that happen? For instance, in this case, for initial scattering length of, you know, -2000, that's corresponding to basically a zero energy resonance, very close to the threshold. And you can see this, in this regimes, when you have the resonance, your scattering cross section or scattering length has changed in magnitude dramatically, your anisotropic parameter is basically 1. So that means in this region, basically you are doing nothing but change the scattering length, change from positive to negative to smaller values to larger values. It is also possible, of course, to come to this region where the S wave completely disappears and you would have an interaction which is completely anisotropic. Of course, this is not a good example here. I have other pictures here. So in this case, for instance, at this particular value, your condensates are only interacting through P wave, through D waves. It's Y20 term, which is dominant. So, I mean, basically you can study how, you know, condensate interacting in some kind of funny way here, because in this region there's basically no spherically symmetric term that is contributing to the interaction. And this is also away from the resonances, so. Okay. What about for the case of fermions? I mean, I just got some of these terms today, so that's why it's a bit disorganized here. In the case of fermions, if they are in the spin triplet state, for instance, and the scattering cross section or scattering amplitude, low energy two body T matrix actually takes this form. So you have T10, T10, Y10, and KY10, K prime, and the T10, 30, and these two are just the complex conjugate of each other. Okay, here this guy should be on this one. And then you have two T30, 30. And we know normally if fermions are interacting through a spherically symmetric potentials, their scattering cross section is zero in the low energy limit, so they are not interacting. That's why people could do, you know, trap the idea of Fermi gases and find what's the properties. But in this case, we can make them interact, not only just interact, make them attracting each other. This is the case where T10 is positive, so corresponding to a negative scattering length. And typically, this guy is about 10 times larger than these guy, and these guys are about 10 times larger than this guy. Until you zip through a resonance, then you can make maybe this guy larger, and all these other terms become very small. This is for the DC electric field. The polarizability of the atom is we took as a cesium, so which is about 405 for cesium, and we are actually currently doing calculations for lithium and potassium. Of course, the cesium, I don't know if there's a fermionic stable isotope. So we're working on this potassium because potassium is close enough to cesium. In fact, there are a lot of analytical properties related to this S matrix, multi-channel S matrix, which I mean, don't want to describe here, but they are rather technical. But if you analyze those properties, you can see clearly that the qualitative behavior for when you apply electric field on potassium, cesium, or rubidium should be roughly similar, because they are about equally polarizable, and all these qualitative differences we see the control parameter is really the electric field strength divided by the square root of the C6 coefficient. Okay. So in this case, for instance, if we can make this the dominant terms, then in the case of lithium 6, we can try to study pairings, P waves pairings, in the same hyperfine state when both spin and the electronic and nuclear spins are polarized. And it's basically you obtain a critical temperature which may actually be reachable. This is A naught, yeah. This is in atomic units. Actually, okay, this is a very good question here. You know, no, this is related to something I'm going to say a little more about. When you think about this, these DC electric fields are rather high in magnitude, yeah. And I showed you these results. Somewhere I got it here. This coefficient CE for a DC electric field has a prefactor of 2 here, yes? There's no frequency denominator because those frequency denominators are all included when you try to calculate the polarizability here. But if you use AC electric field, extremely low frequency, for instance, YAG or CO2, then you can make this polarizability a lot larger. But for AC electric field, you have to average over this cosine omega t squared, so you don't have this 2 anymore. So that's why there's a prefactor of square root of 2 here in this expression. So if it's AC, then you should divide by square root of 2. If it's DC, you should divide by square root of 2. If it's AC, then... For this particular calculation, it is true, but I want to emphasize here, this is a model potential calculation because, I mean, in the beginning, we didn't have the potential. Now we are trying to construct potential. As we already know, you can be lucky. In the rubidium case, for instance, all these scattering lenses work out very well because you might have a bound state which is close to the threshold. Then this thing would move down. So this is a model calculation, and in this particular case, the threshold, the bound state, is about halfway between the two bound states distance.
But it's incredible electrical field.
Yeah. For DC electric field, it's... No. This is wrong.
Do you actually mean 200 times 100 kilovolts per second?
Oh, no. So, sorry, this is, sorry. Okay, yeah. Okay. No, sorry, yeah, this is just, yeah, it's this is a kilovolts. So it's, this in terms of atomic units is of the order of 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 6. So, for instance, we don't have to worry about the stability of an atom. For instance, tunneling is, time scale is longer than the lifetime of the universe. Okay. No, this at this.
Thousand multiplied thousand million volts.
Yeah, atomic units is 10 to the 9, so it's 10 to the minus 5 atomic units. At 300.
Hydrogen, electron volt. Ten electron volts.
Well, I have calculated this somewhere, but at 300 kilovolts per centimeter, this in terms of the atomic units is about 10 to the minus 5. So atom is, I mean, I would assume it would be stable. Of course, in the lab setup, it may not be so stable, you know. But Wolfgang has to worry about that. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, I actually have a few more transparencies here. What is this implications for the fermions? I mean, in this case, if, as indeed, you know, you can realize such a strong interaction between elastic cross-section between fermions, you might start to think about how to do evaporative cooling of fermions. Because normally, people say you can't evaporate cool fermions. And if experimentally this is realizable, you might start to think, can you do the evaporative cooling? And it turns out it's rather interesting. So although the scattering amplitude is anisotropic, but in the ergodic limit, what is entering here of the collision corners is just the scattering cross-section and nothing else. So if you do try to do evaporative cooling, what you will find is that basically everything works until you are very close to the quantum degeneracy when the differences between Bose and Fermi gases show significant. What we find is that you can evaporate and cool this gas as if it was a classical gas up to the limit where the temperature is of the order of 1 to 2 Fermi energies. Then after that, the strong blocking effects due to the Pauli exclusion principle comes in, and then you may want to switch on the sympathetic cooling. Because the cooling all the way from very high temperatures using sympathetic cooling is certainly not something you can make do, because you can have trapped both gases with finite amount, and the total energy it could take out is not that much. Okay, so actually there are some rather interesting dynamics here. Oh, this is, yeah, I agree with you. This is only a...
And if you are going to go towards the GS condition, much faster.
No, why? You can have a P wave pairing. This is the whole point. In fact, you don't want to have a BCS pairing involving different spins, because then inelastic processes become very significant. What you want is trap them in the same spin state, preferably the lowest energetic ones. Is that okay? So I think this afternoon, Marianne from Hank Stoof's group is going to present some BCS pairing in lithium work they've done. I have also done something, so I think maybe I could comment on transparency after your talk. Basically, this anisotropic interactions allows you actually to raise the critical temperature to BCS transient to at the level of the S-wave pairings involving different spins. So I think this is quite good from the point of view of experimental realizations, because if you have a triplet state involving spin in the same state, all the inelastic processes should be a lot lower compared with states involving different spins. Let me try to sum up here. I hope that I have shown that using electric field, you can actually try to manipulate both the sign and the magnitude of the scattering lenses of the, basically you can manipulate the interactions of the low energy quantum gases. And of course the electric field that is required seems to be, you know, at the borderline where I hope someone would be interested in doing this. And I also have some results about how this anisotropic interactions would affect the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. You can have a nonlinear Schrodinger equation involves anisotropically D-wave interactions, and how would it look like? You know, maybe next week sometime here I could give, you know, talk with people. And also I showed that in the case of fermions, when you make them anisotropic, you can actually try to study P-wave pairings in the same spin state. So this would be somewhat similar, you know, if realizable to this so-called Anderson-Morrell state, and which you can do, in fact, in the magnetic trap. But if you can try to trap these fermion gases using optical traps, then you can have, in fact, pairings involving also in superpositions of different spin states. And I think one of the interesting things that maybe experimentalists could try, right now, is to see if electric field-dependent scattering cross-sections for trapped gases which are above critical temperature can be measured. Because this measurement actually would really help us to pin down the sign of the scattering lens. And this, considering, you know, the accuracy that has been achieved, this seems to me, you know, should be something really possible, you know, to try. And I also implied that maybe, you know, we can think about evaporative cooling of fermions so that you evaporate and cool down to somewhat lower temperatures, then switch on the sympathetic cooling. Because with sympathetic cooling, you always have this trouble. You only have a finite amount of cold bosonic gases and how much heat it could take from the fermionic gases. And this whole same approach, theoretical approach we developed here, in fact, can be applied to the cases involving bosons, fermions, and Fermi bosons, you know, basically all kinds of atoms when you're scattering. This potential always shows up. The only difference is the polarizability instead of becoming polarizability of product of the two atoms, of the square of the polarizability of one atom, you have the product of the polarizability of two atoms. And there is also something very interesting is that this E-dependent interactions actually allows you to couple atoms in. You know, there's some ideas how to couple atoms into a magnetic trap as well as couple them out. And for the moment, we are actually working on trying to use AC polarizability specific to repeat these calculations. And this calculation, initially, you know, we were hoping that maybe we can find the realistic values for this, then the Paris group could use this to switch off their bad, you know, zero energy resonances. But, you know, and it turns out for AC polarizabilities, a realistic number you could think about is if you have a laser of 100 watts in a cavity that is focused to 50 microns, basically you can achieve the same order of magnitude of the electric field. So experimentalists seem to say that might be the direction, if they are going to try. Okay? Thanks. Okay, thank you.
Yes. I guess I have a sort of rather generic problem with your numbers, because if for the moment I neglect the rather large enhancement of polarizability in the ultralight, and I just put in the atomic field and compare the coefficient of 1 over r cubed with the standard interaction in sodium, it's only about a factor of 10 greater. So you have a long range, it's 1 over r cubed, so you have a long range possibility extended, but that has to be long range that you cut off the size of the crack, so that can't be a large factor. So, even with your huge enhancement of polarizability, I don't quite see how you get the numbers you do.
Okay, actually, this is a very good question, and here are the numbers. For the electric field we are considering of the order of 100 kilovolts per centimeter, in atomic units, this is about 10 to the minus 5. Okay? So what is the interesting point? And if you realize in all these calculations we've done, we actually only went from zero electric field to about 700 kilovolts per centimeter. And this is determined by the validity of this model. And when you have a 1 over R3 potential and a 1 over R6 potential, these two attractive potentials have to cross each other at somewhere. Because the 1 over R6 is initially larger, this is what you're worried about, but asymptotically, it's going to be 1 over R3 that is going to dominate. What you want to worry about is that what is the interatomic nucleus where these two potential curves cross? And in these electric field regions, that crossing point corresponding to somewhere between 150 atomic units to 1,000 atomic units. We, in fact, can go a lot higher here. The model would still be valid. But then the corrections due to 1 over R5, which is proportional to the E4, we might have to worry a little bit about there. And also the atomic structure locally, we might have to worry a little bit. So that's why we only choose this range where this crossing point is about 150 atomic units to 1,000 atomic units.
Still worried about how you actually did the integrals, as it were, to get your final results, because it looks to me as if you've used infinite spikes, and in fact you've surely got cut off at least at the dimension of the train.
Oh, this, yeah, numerically this is actually extremely tricky, because for the reasons exactly you mentioned is that 1 over R3 has a very, very small coefficient. Okay, actually if, you know, for those of you know who know the mixture, you would not be surprised this can be done. What we did, actually, we used the mathematics to take care of these small values, and eventually you can match into the analytical results, which we know, as I showed you, in the low K limit, everything is proportional to the K. So once you find that result, then everything is converged.
What kind?
In the example over this vector, not only a few of which is made for length, 100 kilovolts per centimeter on standard vectors on the field, which are used in all ions. So you have 100 kilovolts as a unit. If you can go 10 times higher ions over the field, 100 kilovolts is standard in the whole field. So then you can go to 1,000 kilovolts per centimeter, might depend on quality of the electrical setup to special use for that. But I would call your field.
Yeah, I checked this book called Building Experimental Apparatus. This is I failed to become a good experimentalist anyway, so I had this book. And I checked, they say that about 500 kilovolts per centimeter is something that can be done. I mean, so that's why. And I also talked with Michael Chapman. He said, yeah, maybe it's doable. So, okay, this is good news. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah.
Okay. One more question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, you can estimate this using this Shakeshaft as a result, which of course you are very familiar with. Actually, time is longer than the life of the universe, so you don't have to worry about it. So.
Okay, so yes, no more questions. Thanks again.